This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. So what's black and white and red all over? Yeah, right. Newspapers, of course, but these days that's R-E-D, as in red ink. Monday, the once mighty Tribune Corporation filed for Chapter 11. It owns 8 major dailies, plus a radio station and a flock of TV stations. Tuesday, the august New York Times began negotiations with lenders over looming debt payments. U.S. News and World Report, the once feisty number 3 in the weekly magazine race, chose to become a monthly, and number 2, Newsweek, its parent company is the Washington Post, will announce staff cuts and what they call a major makeover. In radio news, this company whacked 2 daily programs and 7% of its workforce yesterday. This latest round of bad news about the news business confirms trends snowballing for years. This is no bump in the road, but part of major changes. Last month, most of us got news of the presidential election from long-established outlets, from radio, TV, and newspapers. It is far from clear how we will get our news of the next one in 2012. Today, we're going to look forward to that date. We'll make a few predictions, but we'll also look back to the days when your hometown paper defined your hometown. A little later, if you're feeling blue, it might not be just the recession. It could be the approach of the solstice. We'll reflect on the darkest days of the year. But first, news in 2012 and the news of yesteryear. How does your local paper, or how did your local paper, define your hometown? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Tom Rosensteel directs the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Tom, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks.
And there was a piece, an editor and publisher last week, that speculated several cities may have no daily newspaper as soon as 2010. That's a year and a month away.
The thing that is important to understand about what's going on in the news business is not only does it make one cough, but the problem isn't really a loss of audience. The audience for a lot of the traditional news organizations in the country is actually growing because younger people are moving to them online. The New York Times audience is bigger than it's ever been and growing for the first time really in 20 years. And that's true of a lot of news organizations. The problem in the news business is not an audience problem. It's a revenue problem. And that problem is that as these audience people, as these consumers move to the internet is turning out to be not a very good platform for delivering the kind of advertising that has subsidized the news.
Also, there was a kind of advertising that subsidized newspapers for, well, centuries, classified ads, and there's no access to that at all anymore.
Well, there is some on the internet in newspaper websites, but a lot of that classified advertising has simply disappeared to free sites like Craigslist or to non-news sites like Monster.com. If I am a consumer and I want to find out how much that flat screen is at Best Buy, I don't have to wait for the Sunday paper and those inserts anymore. I can go to Best Buy's website at 2 in the morning, any night, and find that out for myself. So there's been a decoupling of advertising and news. The biggest problem is that newspapers spend about 40% of their cost printing and delivering the printed product. They could save that 40% overnight if they got rid of their old print editions. But they make 90% of their revenue from the print. And probably half their audience is now online.
And all of these, there seems to be, you hesitate to use these kinds of words, but a death spiral because of the loss of revenue. They cut more jobs and the news hole grows smaller and smaller as the newspaper becomes less valuable, less interesting. There's more wire service material and less locally produced material, less verve, less wit, fewer reviews. Fewer people buy it and the revenue spirals down and there are more cuts.
The way that to really think about the news business is a little different than a lot of people do. Most people probably think it's just dying. It's not really the case. What's going on is that the newspaper industry is a dying industry in print, but an emerging industry online. And as an emerging industry, you would operate it differently. You'd say, okay, get market share, develop a lot of new products, figure out how many users you can get, and toy with a lot of new economic models, a lot of revenue models, and see which ones work. Don't worry right now about making a profit. Worry about growing your revenue, but we'll worry about a profit in 5 or 10 years. And you'd have, instead of banks owning you, you'd have venture capitalists owning you with a different time horizon. Well, the newspaper industry is trying to do both at the same time, and they're owned largely by publicly traded companies that are trading on the stock exchange, not a model for an emerging industry, or by private owners who've borrowed the money from banks and have annual big debt payments that they have to make. Again, not a great model for an emerging long-term horizon industry.
We're talking with Tom Rosensteel of the Project for Excellence in Journalism about where we're going to get our news in 2012. We also want to hear about how your hometown paper defined perhaps your hometown. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Joe's with us. Joe calling from Buffalo, New York.
Yeah, good afternoon. I just have a question, and I'd like to know what your comment would be. It's occurred to me, since our paper locally, the Buffalo News, is of course going through the same kind of spiral you're referring to, but if they just shut down their website, and if I wanted to read about the local sports teams, which of course in Buffalo is very big, or local news, or a review of a play or something, wouldn't I have to buy the paper to get that information? What's the advantage of having a free online source that doesn't cost me anything? I don't buy the paper as much as I used to now because I can go online and just read those articles that I want. What's their advantage of opening a free website and cutting their circulation like that? I'm not sure if I understand the business behind that.
I'm not sure anybody does.
Yeah, it's a really an interesting question. The reason that people are building websites to deliver this stuff, even though they have to give it away, is that that's where the next generation of news consumers operate. People who are 15, 20, 25 years old, they don't read newspapers in print. There was a great worry 10 or 15 years ago that there would be no news consumers in the future because young people didn't read newspapers and didn't tend to watch TV or listen to radio news, although they do that in greater numbers than they read in print. And what we've discovered is, no, that next generation is interested in the news, but they want it in a different platform and they want it in a different way. They want it online and they want what they want when they want it. They're more demanding news consumers.
And those people are accustomed to the culture of the Internet where all of this stuff is free.
They're not going to pay for it. We know that much. That's increasingly clear. And if you did what Joe's speculating about, some new competitor would create a website in Buffalo that would have a lot of that stuff, maybe not as well as the Buffalo News is doing it. They would be the growing news organization in town because they'd have all that emerging audience, and the readers of that print edition are getting older and older and older, and there's a limited supply of them.
Joe, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, you're welcome.
Appreciate it. Let's see if we can go to Jeffrey. Jeffrey with us from Des Moines.
Yeah, the Des Moines Register is also not surprisingly suffering cuts, and I think one of the things that I miss, you asked that question, is foreign correspondence. I had to do a graduate study and went through microfilm and was surprised to see that the Des Moines Register of the 60s, like the New York Times of the 60s, may have had a reporter stationed in Turkey and another in South Asia. And one of the things I found as a teacher with my students is that as some of them start to read the Independent or newspapers from overseas online, they sometimes gravitate and read more of those papers. I think the homogenization I wanted to ask about, even with the Associated Press being sort of the wire service and not as many people having access to Reuters and in different wire services, if perhaps a lot of our newspapers are doing themselves a disservice by not offering more diverse information or something beyond sort of a U.S. official said style of reporting.
Yeah, the a great example, the Boston Globe, which had one of the best foreign services in the world, and the Boston Globe shut down all of its foreign offices.
Yeah, the thinking here, which I think is frankly too literal by these news companies, is we've got to cut costs because our revenues are declining. What are the most expensive things that are not essential to what we do? And they say, well, you could get foreign coverage from the New York Times or the Wires, and if we close our foreign bureaus, one reporter, you know, costs twice as much as a reporter does here. We could have two reporters for the price of one foreign correspondent. The problem with that thinking is that people in Baltimore want to think of Baltimore as a cosmopolitan city and want to read a newspaper that reflects those interests and not just has generic wire copy for those interests. And a newspaper defines the identity of a town, the personality of a town, the breadth of a viewpoint of a town.
The way it thinks of itself.
Exactly. And if you kill those things and you make the newspaper so provincial, you make it something people don't want to read, which is why, interestingly, to his point, one of the fastest growing publications in the United States is The Economist, which is from England. Half of its readership is now in the U.S.
Interesting point, too, but we're going to be talking in a few minutes with a couple of people who are involved with newspapers, one of which is growing and one of which is not. Both of them, as it happens, are based in Baltimore, Maryland, the African American, and also the Baltimore Sun, the more traditional paper there. But as you look at these situations, Tom, there's a revolution against the AP, too. Its members are saying, wait, this is too expensive, and you're giving away product free on the Internet as well. Why are you competing with us?
Yeah, the Associated Press is so interesting, was started by newspapers in the middle of the 19th century to supply them with material from abroad. The telegraph had just been invented, and people said, well, we need news from elsewhere, so we'll own the AP, we'll pay a small fee for them to have these reporters, and then we'll use this material. So the AP was a supplier to newspapers. Now, online, it's become a competitor. And the papers are saying, why do we have to pay you all this money when you've become our rival?
What would they fill the paper with if it wasn't the AP, though? There's a good question. We'll talk about where we're going to get our news in 2012, just 4 years away. We'll continue with Tom Rosensteel. We'll also talk with Jake Oliver, the publisher and CEO of the Afro-American Newspapers in Baltimore. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Fewer people watch the evening news. Fewer read newspapers. USA Today and the Wall Street Journal saw tiny increases in circulation earlier this year. Other dailies report falling circulation, 3.5% on average. For most Americans, the way we get our news is changing. We're talking about what the news business might look like 4 years from now. We already talked about some of the cutbacks. How will you get the news in 2012? Our guest is Tom Rosensteel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He also serves as vice chairman of the Committee of Concerned Journalists. And let's go to one of the publishers on the front lines of the new media environment, Jake Oliver, publisher and CEO of the Afro-American Newspapers in Baltimore, with us on the line from his office there in Baltimore, Maryland. Nice to have you on the program today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And in some ways, you had a good year.
Yes, we did. Not the best of all years, but I feel blessed compared to what I see around me. And, you know, it's a whole lot has to do with the evolution that we're all witnessing and the challenges that the technologies are bringing to bear on forcing us to do things differently.
And is your revenue stream holding up, the advertising, as well as circulation?
Yes. And I don't want to say that too fast, however, you know, because it hasn't been as good as it has been, let's say, in past years, particularly 2005, 2006 were good years for us. Matter of fact, among the best years. And in 2007, things really started to, you know, slow down. In 2008 was not as bad as the slowdown in 2007, but it wasn't as good as it was in 2006. Probably the highlights of what we're witnessing in 2008 right now is primarily directly related to the fallout coming from the campaign, the politics.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to go away soon.
And it may, you know, what it has done is it's sort of rejuvenated a large part of our market's interest in print.
I wonder, though, as the coverage of all communities diminishes from mainstream newspapers, do your opportunities increase?
I'm not so sure that it does. You know, I don't think that we're getting fallout from what is basically escaping from mainstream, because our market really isn't that big. You know, as far as you know, the mainstream newspapers are concerned, but we're quite frankly, we're looking at the digital world as really beginning to open up opportunities, and we're trying to understand it as fast as we can, along with everyone else, and not certain exactly that every step that we take is going to be the complete answer. Matter of fact, we know that there's not going to be one solution. It's going to be a whole different accumulation of different things as we understand the new habits of people and how they want to receive their news and how they're going to respond to news, and understanding this thing called community journalism, which is in many respects challenging but also very enlightening. We're having fun, and in the bottom line, I guess, is what I'd.
A conundrum that many organizations, including this one, face is, well, you need to spend money on that digital side to develop your website and make it attractive and find those readers and find a business model. In the meantime, of course, it's not bringing in much money, if any.
No. Right now, it doesn't by itself, compared to what it did back in the middle 90s before the dot-com bust happened, where we really realized a fair amount of money compared to, you know, most newspapers, because we were so far out in front of everything. But right now, it's not generating enough money to really absolutely pay for itself. But it's beginning to.
Hmm.
And the thing is that maybe 2 years ago, the magic word was, well, yeah, I have a website, and that would have been satisfactory for, let's say, your national advertisers to look at you. But now that's not enough. But we're beginning to get far more interest from particularly national advertisers as to, okay, if you're on the web, what do you do? What kind of publications? What types of things are you basically, what is your circulation like, and how are you building that, and how are you getting people to respond, and what are you doing about this thing of building communities? We're finding that's more and more becoming important to larger national advertisers, and it's compelling us, and if nothing else, is giving us a direction as to how we have got to basically change in order to be able to address these opportunities, because those dollars are coming directly from their print budget, and they're shifting over to the digital side, and we plan to be ready with the digital publications and the digital actions that will not only reach these audiences, which are far broader than the print. When we talk about the Afro, you generally think in terms of Baltimore and Washington, to a lesser extent the subscribers who are located all across the country, but in a far smaller numbers. But when you're dealing with a digital environment,
that's worldwide.
You've got the whole world, but more importantly, you've got the national, and then you've got the world, and that's where our perspective, I think, it becomes far more competitive, if not far more interesting, because it's one thing to read about a story which focuses on some aspect of the black community in the New York Times, digital or print, but if in fact you're offshore in Europe or in the Middle East, you want to get their particular specific perspective of the people who live there.
You spoke about the interest generated by the presidential campaign. We should point out the Gina Six story, about which you were a pioneer. That was important, too. But I wonder, 4 years from now, do you think you're going to have a print edition?
I'm sorry. I can barely hear you.
4 years from now, are you still going to be publishing a print
edition? Oh, yes. I don't think this evolution is going to change. It was funny. Back in 97, we were thinking, well, we'll be publishing probably for 7 years, and I think the rest of the world will probably not be reading papers after that point. I think it's going to be the evolution away from print is going to take far longer than what everyone originally planned. But I think it's also very generational, because obviously the college kids these days are never going to probably pick up a paper. But, you know, we have to wait until they grow old before we realize the impact of their absence.
Tom?
And not replacing the ones who, you know, mm-hmm. my generation who grew up with the newspapers.
I think because the Internet is not generating the kind of revenue as rapidly as people expected, that newspapers are going to want to hang on to that print edition
yeah.
as long as they can to keep that revenue coming. And what you're going to see in daily newspapers that are mainstream is in the next year people killing one day or 2 days a week of the print edition,
mm-hmm.
figuring that you'll get those ads that you would have lost on those days on other days,
mm-hmm.
but you'll save the cost of printing on a Tuesday or a Thursday. So you'll reduce your costs without damaging your revenue quite as much. And that's a sort of a halfway measure that I think you're going to see over the next 4 or 5 years more and more of.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think part of that challenge is how do you replace those, you know, those print readers? How do you get them committed? And, you know, are they different people or are they the same people who you've been able to more or less wean away from their old habits of the tangible necessity of having something in their hand? Instead, they may have it on in their phone. Or on their workstation. But, yeah, the question is how do you get them across that bridge so that you're not basically losing that circulation that is the base of how you can expect to be able to continue to attract the advertising revenue.
Jake Oliver, we wish you the best of luck.
Well, thank you very much.
Jake Oliver with us on the phone from his office in Baltimore, publisher and CEO of the Afro-American Newspapers in Baltimore. And let's see, we get a caller on the line. This is Clinton with us from Birmingham, Michigan.
Hi, Neil.
Hi there.
Neil, I think I want to make a couple of points. I think that I was talking to a major Metro columnist yesterday, and her point was that newspaper editors and publishers are too busy putting out their papers every day to think about the alternatives and what we'll be looking at 4 years from now. The thought arises that the crisis may have to get to the point where papers go under before alternatives emerge and begin to thrive. I was an editor at the Detroit Free Press for about 10 years, from 1980 to 1990. And after 10 years out of journalism in 2001, before blogs became popular and growing out of my own personal desire for political activism, I started what was essentially a blog here in Birmingham that sought to influence planning and other public policy in our small but influential community of 20,000. We're right outside of Detroit, and we're the home to many business and cultural leaders of the Detroit area. And back then, even as the major metros were still vital here, and with two small local papers operating in our area, I and others, those who supported me, felt the need for a more sophisticated voice with perhaps more intelligent reporting and more incisive commentary on local issues affecting us. And for me, it was a ton of work. I worked for 20 to 40 hours a week for about 5 years, but I gave it up a couple of years ago. I've been watching the movement, which is now being called hyper-local or citizen journalism. And you're seeing groups of people meeting at journalism schools around the country to talk about this sort of thing. And what it is on a very local scale, sometimes journalists, part activists, part social networks, where a website is formed to serve a small community, sometimes even a neighborhood. There's a very vital one in I believe it's West Seattle. And these sites become essential and compelling sources of information for their communities. But the problem that these sites are having is the same as the problem the big papers face.
Can't make any money.
Sustainability, right. And I think what we've seen for many, many years in our country is that business and advertising has been the basis, the support for good journalism. But that's going to have to change, because as the advertising dollars go elsewhere, you know, we're going to have to look perhaps to nonprofit and foundation support. And I believe it's the St. Petersburg Times is owned by a foundation, the Poynter Foundation.
Yes, yes, it is.
And there's, I guess, you know, I don't know, I haven't looked at their balance sheet, but...
Well, I think a lot of that foundation money is invested on Wall Street, so they may have some problems too. But Clinton, thanks very much for the call. It's a very interesting point.
Thanks.
Here's an email from Monica in Lockport, New York. Great conversation. Although purchase of newspapers is declining, people still want real actual copies after a big event. For example, the Buffalo News decided to print 15,000 extra copies of the November 5th edition because people wanted a commemorative copy for the Obama victory. The news printed these extra copies 2 days later. So did the Washington Post and a bunch of other newspapers, too. We're talking about where we're going to be getting our news in 2012 after the next presidential election. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tim Franklin is editor of the Baltimore Sun. On Monday, his paper reported some disturbing news that its parent, the Tribune Corporation, filed for bankruptcy. Tim Franklin with us today from the studios at the Baltimore Sun. Now, welcome, and thanks for taking the time out of a busy day.
Neil, good to be with you.
And your paper's already gone through a lot since you took the job in 2004, and a lot of that's been downhill?
Well, I wouldn't say it's been reduced staffing, which is, I think, something every newspaper in the country has been going through. And in response to your recent caller, including the St. Petersburg Times, I have some of my best friends who are editors there, but they're not immune to the market forces that are happening in the industry right now. And so, yes, we have fewer staffers. There's no question about it. You can't deny that. We have about 225 in the newsroom now. And we were in the mid-300s or high-300s when I arrived 5 years ago. And we're also doing much more. We're doing more with the website. We're doing more niche publications than we've ever done before. So we're trying to figure this thing out with a staff that our revenue levels can support.
The Baltimore Sun and the Sun papers have defined that city for so long. Going back to Mencken, this is something that has been utterly vital to that city and how it thinks of itself. And if a city, certainly the size of Baltimore, doesn't have a vital newspaper, maybe it isn't a city.
Well, I think this is a vital newspaper, Neil, and I think there's no better evidence of that than just this week, when our reporters uncovered a pay raise that the mayor and the city council snuck through for themselves a few days ago, and it sparked a huge outrage here in the community. Would I love to have more reporters? Absolutely. You bet I would. Do we still have by far the biggest news organization in Maryland and one that very aggressively covers the news and is passionate about covering the news? Absolutely, we do. You're right. A newspaper's job is to lead the community conversation. We play a pivotal role in democracy. We play a pivotal role in terms of our public service journalism. And, you know, God help us, if that should ever go away. I don't think it is. But this paper is still, you know, by far the largest news voice in the state. And I think we'll continue to be.
And sets the priority, sets the agenda in Annapolis. It sets the agenda there, too, as well as in that's the state capital, as well as in Baltimore. And as you look at the importance of this institution and then you look at the news that your parent corporation has filed for Chapter 11, that's not the end, hardly. That's reorganization. But nevertheless, it can't be good news.
Well, it was certainly jarring, and it's created a lot of anxiety in the newsroom. But I can tell you that people are still very focused on their jobs. They're still producing good stories. And really, Neil, what this is an attempt to get some breathing room to reorganize the debt load of the company. The Sun is still a profitable newspaper, not nearly as profitable as it was even a year ago. But all of the Tribune properties, as I understand it, are still cash flow positive. So I think with this move, the hope is they can buy themselves some time to reorganize the debt. But the fact that we are still profitable, I think, bodes well for us coming out of bankruptcy.
Can you stay with us for a couple of minutes?
Sure.
All right. We're going to continue this conversation when we come back from a short break. Again, if you'd like to get involved in the talk, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. We're talking right now with Tim Franklin, editor and senior vice president of the Baltimore Sun, Maryland's largest news organization. Also still with us, Tom Rosenstiel of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. When we come back, we're also going to be talking about the darkest days of the year as we run up to the solstice and about, well, waiting for light, waiting for hope. So we'll be involved in that conversation as well. We'll talk with James Carroll, a columnist at the Boston Globe. Yeah, we rely on newspapers too, a lot. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now we're talking about the future of the newspaper business, the future of the news business. Our guests are Tom Rosensteel of the Project for Excellence in Journalism and Tim Franklin, the editor and senior vice president at the Baltimore Sun. I just want to read some emails that we've gotten. This from Gene in Gastonia, North Carolina. I think this recession is going to change the way we get our news. Recently, our household has had to drop cable. I've heard relatively little about how the cable industry is doing, but like everything else, it has to be a non-essential luxury. This may help the newspaper industry with the younger consumer. The internet may provide some of my news education, but not all. This from Alan in Concord, California. One problem I have with the new news model is the notion that reading news is a self-directed activity, that people will read about what they want to read about on the web. I've always thought of newspapers as informing me as to what was the news. It's an educational and informative service that made me aware of important events and provided the depth of information to allow me to form an informed opinion. I guess depth of knowledge and informed opinion are passé. And this from Kathy in Meriden. I've read the daily newspaper wherever I've lived for more than 70 years, but our local newspaper keeps giving less info all the time, and the cost goes up. Can't imagine not getting the paper, but I get most of my news online and from NPR. The local paper is a McClatchy paper. I see great reporting they do online, but rarely in our local paper, and I don't understand that. I feel our daily paper and national and local TV have given up on real reporting and spend most of the time on human interest stories, which are not news to me. And Tom Rosensteel?
Well, the challenge that Tim has at the Sun is fascinating because as you manage your costs and you have to manage your newsroom and shrink it so it's sustainable, do you reach a point at which you begin to lose readers because they say, well, this isn't the same paper that it used to be? Tim's clearly right that there's in every community, the newspaper has more boots on the ground, is the largest news gathering organization. And what we're seeing, I think, is at the same time as some of these reporters who leave newspapers are creating niche websites that are trying to cover communities or cover specific subjects, you also have government, which is trying to talk directly to voters through Barack Obama's got 13 million, apparently, emails. You've got corporations who are doing this. That also is more of a challenge for news organizations because they've got to somehow monitor those private conversations, those unfiltered conversations for the rest of us. So the task of journalism is actually enlarging while the resources to do it are shrinking. And the ways that people are getting news is expanding, and it's very tough.
And also, Tim Franklin, those reporters who are filing for the Baltimore Sun also have to file for the website.
They do, and they're also shooting video for the website and getting audio for the website and blogging for the website. So there's no question we're asking more of people than we have in the past. I think, you know, my good friend Tom raises some very good points, as usual.
When he says good friend, I worry, Tom.
No,
it's going to be a block.
Actually, Tim and I know each other and like each other
a lot. Okay, go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, no, we Tom and I go way back. I would say two things. I think that newspapers need to know their audience, and they need to know how they fit with that audience. And I guess what I'm trying to say is I think more papers like The Sun have become more local than they used to be. There was the notion that a newspaper was one-stop shopping with all the international business and feature entertainment news that you could possibly want. And I think as resources have shrunk, we've had to be much more focused about what our mission is. And our mission is to be the number one newspaper in Maryland. And so, you know, we've attempted to do that. And I think other metro papers have attempted to do the same thing. The other critical thing for our future is original reporting, investigative reporting, enterprise reporting that nobody else can do or has the resources to do or the will to do. And that sets us apart from everybody else and I think provides a value proposition, if you will, for readers to keep coming back to us because they're going to find things in the newspaper they're not going to get off the television news or off cable during the course of the day.
So a local newspaper, an intensely local newspaper, but again, we were talking earlier, there was that agenda-setting priority. People wanted to find out what was going on in London and around the world.
You know, I think there's a difference between being myopic and being local. I mean, the key is relevance. You know, what stories are relevant to readers? And sometimes those relevant stories are the bailout of the auto industry, which is very much a national story. It's the new president and what he's doing with his administration. But I think that some editors make the mistake of just thinking local, local, local. I think the key more has to do with relevance and what stories connect.
Let's see if we get one last caller in on this topic. Dan with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Yeah, Neil, just a real quick point. They keep talking about free access to the newspaper, but anybody who isn't accessing on the web is paying some other price to access the Internet. And, you know, when we had the model for TV news switched to a cable where it became almost like a utility bill that you had to pay monthly, then, you know, to add on top of that a subscription to a paper on top of your subscription to the Internet is where I think most households find the problem. And maybe the best is either to find a way to get some of that revenue from the Internet providers.
The way that a lot of the cable operations get it from subscription services. Yeah.
Right.
Here's another suggestion. Jason in San Francisco, I feel guilty not paying for online content, would be happy to make a penny an article micropayment. Would you agree with that, Dan?
I think that was something along that line would have to work out. But, I think that when you're already writing one check off to somebody to turn on your box, whether it's your phone, your iPhone or your Internet or whatever, that writing an additional cost, writing out another check is where it gets more dicey, I think, for most people.
Tom?
I think Dan's really onto something, that you could get people to build in a little more into their Internet access fee. I think there's real potential there that the newspaper industry is not exploiting. But you got to remember, subscriptions only account for 20% of total revenue of newspapers, so that's not the final solution.
Dan, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
And I'd like to thank Tim Franklin for his time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
Tim Franklin, the editor and senior vice president at the Baltimore Sun, with us today from a bureau at the Baltimore Sun. And Tom Rosensteel with us here in Studio 3A. He's the director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. As always, Tom, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Neil.
We'll be talking about the darkness in just a moment.